Finn is a permaculture teacher and permaculture practitioner. We've talked about the seven domains of permaculture over the previous seven interviews that all happened last year in 2023. And we wanted today to talk about systems. And first of all, what actually do we mean by systems? Why is this something we want to talk about?
Yeah, so I guess from a permaculture lens, is systems are integral, I would say, to permaculture thinking and permaculture practice, and always have been. And why I think systems are important is, you know, similar to the conversation we just had around colonization, is if we don't understand the larger way in which things have come to be the way they are, if we don't understand the whole, then we're likely to jump to simple solutions. And simple solutions are almost always, they almost always fail.
Yeah.
Simply because they are kind of misguided and are based on a whole bunch of assumptions. So the way nature operates, for example, is, you know, one of the most complex systems we know of. You know, the human brain is a complex system. Mm. And so understanding, and not all systems are equal either, but essentially systems are about holes that have a whole bunch of components or parts and features to them that interact and have a range of different relationships. And some of those can be really simple, and some of those can be really complex. Sometimes systems are chaotic, usually only for a short period of time. But and so basically being able to understand systems, I think, makes us wiser, because we can make more informed choices. We can reduce, you know, things like black and white thinking and jumping to really simple solutions, you know, if therefore kind of conclusions, which sometimes are appropriate, but most of the time it's, again, just based on a lack of understanding about the way things actually are.
So the thing that got me paying attention to it was that, like, things are too complicated. Like, what's happening with in a population, it's too complicated to track every person and understand the decisions they're making and how that affects how the population. You can't do it by getting all that information and then trying to work out what the country's going to do. It's just way too, humans can't do it. So systems thinking was a way of coping with anything that was that complex. And it's not just about people, it's like the whole ecosystem. What happens in the ocean? You can't follow every molecule of water. You know, you can't do it that way. It makes no sense to do it. And having said that, I think probably the thing that triggered me into this most of all was, and some people might want to ring up and argue with me about this, but the way that modern conventional economics thinking is done kind of actually doesn't use, in fact, there's been widespread criticism that they don't use systems thinking, that they are still stuck in that thing of, here's, it was all based on what one person would do and then extrapolating up from there.
I mean, I think there's lots of things in there that for me are quite interesting to explore and unpack. One of the things that I think is interesting is systems, and system science is one of those ways in which science is kind of catching up with itself and realizing its own shortcomings.
Yeah.
So from a, I guess historically speaking, is kind of Western science is really about almost the opposite of systems thinking. It's about reductionism, because similar to what you were saying is, you know, you can understand what's happening because of the human limitations of being able to understand complexity, is we'd reduce things down to their most simple elements.
Yes.
And then if we could understand things in isolation, then we'd say we understand that thing.
But there's such a thing as emergent properties as things become more complex.
Well, that's what we know now, is that, that you can understand living processes. You know, it works for things like, to a degree, you know, chemistry, or, you know, there are elements that you can understand by isolating them.
Yeah.
But if you want to understand complex living systems, you can't take them apart and then think you understand them. So there are, yeah, like you said, there's emergence, which is a core fundamental concept within systems, which is, novel things emerge through the interaction and relationships and the dynamic processes between within a system.
So I guess if you like, you can't understand people by figuring out what our molecules and atoms are.
Yeah, I mean, you could. There's some insights that you can gain.
Yeah,
but that doesn't lead to a holistic understanding. And so I guess systems thinking or system science is really about trying to understand the whole as a dynamic system. And so, you know, we can look at things like patterns, understanding dynamics, the interactions and the relationships between different things. And then even things like dependencies and constraints. You know, we know from in systems that some things rely on other things to then for other things to be able to happen. And systems are constrained. Systems are always constrained by things like energy, resource availability, and whether in this case we're talking about, you know, the availability of nitrogen or carbon, or, you know, in the case of our global society, if we're talking about things like copper or oil or any number of resources. Systems always have constraints. And so some of these kind of concepts are actually really helpful when we're trying to understand anything in its more holistic sense.
Have we got an example of something that we can... Did you prepare an example ahead of time?
In terms of examples of systems thinking?
Systems thinking, where we've gained some insights from it, I think.
Yeah. Well, so I think one of the more sophisticated ones that I can think of off the top of my head... Oh, so that was another point I was wanting to make, is from that science lens, it's kind of interesting is that, you know, systems science is now maturing as a discipline, but it's kind of unpicking a lot of our historic scientific approaches and methods, which were about reductionism.
Yeah.
But then we know from, you know, I don't know what you'd call it, non-Western science, from indigenous wisdom and knowledge that's accumulated over generations, we have some, you know, systems thinking is completely embedded into that. So the example I was going to use was Maramataka. So Maori hapu or iwi calendars is a lunar calendar. So understanding the relationship between the movement of the celestial bodies and the movement of the moon with the pulsing of water, and then how different ecosystems and how different living organisms within that interact in those ways in really sophisticated and nuanced ways. So knowing what animals were active at what times of the lunar cycle, that requires quite a rich understanding of the larger system, because then you need to be able to work out, well, which dynamics are changing and shifting, and then understanding the frequency or the predictability and the reliability of that, and then how weather and climatic events and all of those play together. So that requires quite a sophisticated understanding of the natural world to be able to take in all these little bits of information and then understand them as a complex whole.
But they're not taking in little bits of information to the detail that modern science can.
So you're not excluding any of the other information.
Yeah,
I think that's one of the things about systems thinking, is it's not about reductionist. It's not saying if I just ignore everything else so I can home in on this one thing that I'm trying to understand.
Yeah.
But it's going, how do I keep track? How do I track that at the same time that I'm tracking all these other variables? And again, that's where I think things like the Maramataka are actually quite quite sophisticated examples of systems thinking in action.
I remember when I was looking into genetic engineering, there was a thing where someone had done some research and said, we grew this GE plant and here's what happened.
Hmm.
And then people, the critics were saying, well, you grew it in sterile soil.
Hmm.
So what sort of a test is that? It's a sort of thing you do in a laboratory, is take out all the variables.
That's it.
But then you also can't really, well, that's great, you learned something, but what's actually going to happen in real soil?
So that's it. There's, I think, a time and place for reductionistic science, but not if you're thinking that explains, you have no idea how that's actually going to translate into the real world, quote unquote, because the real world is a complex living system. You know, there's all these variables, and we can't control or isolate our environment in the real world. So I guess permaculture is really about how do we work with natural systems and rhythms in real time, in real places, with the rest of the living world that exists in that place.
Okay, so we've got a piece of land, we're growing things.
Mm.
I'm trying to get into a real world example, because it's quite a systems thinking is quite a hard thing to get your head around what do we actually do. Like, we've established that it's not reductionism, it's the opposite of reductionism, and we need that because the world's really complicated. But yeah,
so I guess in terms of, so there's an example out there that I think is kind of interesting, that again I think has come from a degree of systems literacy, which is called Liebig's law, or the law of the minimum. So if you were using an example of growing plants, despite what we might think, I don't know, intuitively, or some assumptions we might make about what most impacts the health and well-being of a plant, it's actually what's the scarcest supply. And so we know that we can try to grow a plant that has really healthy soil, has good access to water. But if the greatest scarcity in the environment is nitrogen, then it doesn't matter how much phosphorus, how much carbon, how much whatever else you might have, how much water, how deep your A-horizon soil strata is, all the rest of it, is that plant is not going to grow into a healthy plant, because nitrogen is the most scarce feature.
Yeah.
And so it doesn't, you know, that's just an example. But things like the law of the minimum is through study of a whole system and going, oh, so it's actually the thing that is in the scarcest supply that is has the largest influence on the health and well-being of the plant. And so how do we apply that in the real world? Well, then we're starting to not just focus on, oh, well, I just need to water the plant and it's going to grow, but we're actually interested in cultivating the most ideal conditions. We're tracking a whole range of different variables.
So you're coming back to using some science, some like...
Yeah, or at least observation.
Right.
You know, so again, whether you're using a lab to do soil testing or not, you can use things like soil indicators. So what are the plants that are growing there? Those will tell you quite a bit about what's in the soil. You can use, again, plant indicators to tell you quite a bit about the moisture levels in the soil. You can even just do things like, you know, quite simple moisture tests. You know, there's any number of things you can do that I guess we can call it science. And, you know, and it is, but it doesn't, it's accessible to all of us, you know, and it's really about just observation and understanding how different dynamics play out. Taking, I guess, another example, thinking from the more of a societal perspective is, and this is, you know, this can go both ways, but, you know, Naomi Klein wrote a famous book called The Shock Doctrine. And one of the things she was explaining in that was basically how governments had worked out that the greatest opportunity to bring in significant change, political change in the system, is after a major disturbance.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly not governments that are the only people to work that out. But that's, from my mind, an example of looking at and understanding systems. So when systems are stable, they're very rigid to change.
Yeah.
And so it's usually after what's called a release phase, but after there's this a disturbance and some uncertainty, the system's trying to restabilize, reorganize itself. And that's the time where both for quote-unquote good or quote-unquote bad, significant change can happen. And so, for example, one of the things that I'm, you know, I would argue that right now we are in what I call late conservation. We're in quite a stable state at a society in a global economic state, but I think we're in late conservation. So there's almost certainly going to be at least one, but a series of release events that destabilize the system. And again, there's a whole range of reasons for that.
Are we talking economic, cultural, ecological?
We're talking systems. So yes, all of those.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, well, yeah, political.
Because if the ecological system destabilizes, that will affect the cultural and the economic.
It absolutely
political,
will. Yep. Totally. And we know that from history, across time, across, you know, we've had, what, 26 civilizations? And, you know, over the last, what, 8,000 years. And so we're pretty confident that we know how things kind of play out. And it is a combination of all of those things are highly interlocked. And again, through things like emergence, we don't know whether it's going to be an economic shift that's going to push a political or a cultural shift, or whether it'll be, you know, but there's all these different moving elements
Yeah, so many moving elements, you can't track all of them. It's like, I guess if you go back to previous mass extinctions, I presume, because I don't know much about them, the detail of them, but I presume you lost a lot of species and then a whole new ecological system, well, not a completely new one, but
I think that's a great example.
So we tend to think, oh, if you take this species out of the ecosystem, then that's going to affect that, and we get this catastrophic thinking where it's all going to be over because we took that link out of the link out of the chain. But it doesn't work. But the ecosystem doesn't work like that.
Well, yes and no. So I think there are things like keystone species, which again I think is another good example of kind of systems thinking. We know that some species within ecosystems are more critical to the health and well-being of that system than others.
Yeah.
And so, you know, for here we know like tamuri and snapper and the critical role they play in coastal ecology. And if their numbers diminish, you have a systems change and we enter into a much more impoverished coastal ecosystem.
Yeah.
Overseas, it's things like, you know, you take out the beaver and you have a similar negative impact on freshwater ecology, or whales in marine environments, or, you know, the wolves in a lot of forest ecosystems. So they're all what's called keystone species. They play this essential role in managing the health and well-being of the whole species. And if you do take them out, then therefore that ecosystem, there are fairly catastrophic impacts. The system no longer functions optimally, and certainly not the way it did. But I think what you're speaking to in terms of extinctions is there is also a lot to be said about creative destruction. And that's what happens when I was talking about that kind of release phase, is that is a form of creative destruction, and it creates opportunities for something new to emerge. And
evolution goes into overdrive at that time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so using your example of the last major extinction is, you know, about 65 million years ago, once the collision hit and the dinosaurs went extinct, that paved way for mammals. And then this incredible explosion of new forms of life that the world had never seen before.
Yeah.
And, you know, arguably the most diversity that's ever existed in this, you know, whatever 4 billion years of life journey has all emerged out of this catastrophic extinction event that killed off, you know, over 80% of all life on planet Earth. Mm. And so, again, this is all part of that kind of larger systems way of understanding. And I think one of the things that I think is really important about systems and systems thinking is hopefully it's a bit of a cure to black and white thinking, or kind of that dualism.
Yeah.
You know, yes, no, or things are good or bad.
I have an interesting example of that. Well, I think it's an interesting example. People talk. I've seen people trying to alert the world to the concept of dead zones, like in the sea at the end of the Mississippi River. Mm. And you've got to understand, I just saw a map of the tributaries of the Mississippi the other day. It's like half of the continental USA literally comes out through the Mississippi River, or the water. And so there's meant to be a dead zone in the sea out there. And you hear dead zone and you think, well, everything's dead.
Mm.
But then I discovered that there's no oxygen in the water that's coming out. So all the species that depend on oxygen, certainly they're not surviving. But there are actually a lot of anaerobic species out there. I don't know if that's quite the right term.
It is.
But things like jellyfish. So in fact, actual fact, there still is life. It's not a dead zone.
Mm.
It's just not what it used to be. And probably you could say it's not what it's supposed to be. We've certainly messed it up.
Mm.
But yeah, that's that black and white thinking. Like, it's not a dead zone. It's a new thing.
Yeah.
And it certainly probably isn't good for us. We'd have to completely change the way we eat and fish and all that kind of thing to survive based on that area of water. But yeah, it's not the end of the world.
That's it. And yeah. I think I think it's easier, maybe, I don't know, easier, but, you know, giving those examples from the natural environment. But I think there's also a relevance at a human society culture level. And this is, I guess, one of the, you know, one of my, I guess, more significant concerns is what I've seen emerging over the last decade is around, you know, this concept of othering, or us and them, you know, this kind of new tribalism that's not about, well, I guess it does provide belonging and identity and those kind of things, but it's incredibly destructive. And, you know, we've just gone through a political cycle, and, you know, the rhetoric that usually comes up with those is, you know, if then kind of really simplistic statements or they did this, therefore. And it's really, to my mind, completely lacking in a deeper understanding of the way the world actually works. It's just this kind of simple throwaway sentences that if you vote for me, then this will happen. Well, we all know that that's not the way the world works. And yes, people can, you know, write policy and on the rest of it, but that doesn't, the world is too complex, too dynamic for things to be communicated in such simple terms. But what it does do is I think it reduces the average person's ability to think critically. And systems gives us this lens to be able to understand that there's almost always more going on than that kind of simple way of framing things.
The soundbite electioneering.
That's exactly right.
The thing that probably frustrates me the most is when you hear politicians talking about the national economy like it's a household economy, saying you wouldn't spend more than you earn. And you wouldn't in a household, but a national economy is not the same. And the government is the single most influential player in a national economy. And the money it spends also gets back in tax. So and that's a very, very, very glossed over description of the differences between a household and a national economy. It's way, way, way more complex than that.
Well, and I think even some of that other kind of electioneering type rhetoric, which is, you know, things like, you know, we'll fix the economy. And it's, you know,
well, that's meaningless statement, isn't it?
It is. I mean, because on so many levels, because the idea that any one person or any one political party has the ability to, quote unquote, fix anything, I think is, and again, I'm not saying that governments are completely ineffective, but the idea that they're somehow in control or have the ability to significantly shape a complex living organism or superorganism just by wanting to, by making a policy change here or there, I think is incredibly naive. One of the things that I've heard a lot of in the last decade, but, you know, that's moved into New Zealand politics is, you know, getting the country back on track. Or,
That's a play for the nostalgia vote, isn't it?
But that in and of itself shares a lot of, there's a lot of richness in that kind of the backdrop of what's in the system, which is the system shifted and changed and people want it to be like the way it was. But again, it's quite naive that idea, again, that I think that a political party or a government has the ability to shape our shared experience in that significant way. You know, like governments have very little control over, say, things like international energy supply or war and peace in other countries. You know, we can provide diplomatic roles and all the rest of it, but, you know, New Zealand's role in directly doing much about what's happening in the Middle East or, you know, in the Balkans or any number, I think there's just a lot of overly simplistic and kind of scapegoating type things out there that I think systems allow us to think more critically, more dynamically. You know, another one, I guess, is in the space around climate, or, you know, there's a lot of things that we can unpack related to systems around climate. So the focus that people have on carbon, and all we need to do is address carbon, and then somehow we'll quote unquote fix climate change. But carbon's just the symptom, you know? So again, I think that's myopic thinking.
I know. And one of the things that alarmed me was seeing activists who should know better talking about, because one of the things that's happened one of the solutions is you measure for your country, you measure your output, and then you cut it back. And of course, New Zealand does heaps of farming and disproportionately so. And I've seen someone saying, well, we just have to stop producing that food, and those people overseas, they'll just have to get their food somewhere else.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, there's a huge amount of callousness there, but even if you are that callous, you can at least recognize that if you starve a bunch of people overseas because of what we've done, then that's going to have all sorts of blowback effects. But it's also, it's kind of pointless looking at it that way when 90% of our food goes somewhere else. Why are we calculating it based on that?
Yep.
And then I got into more details about, well, what's actually happening on farms with the ecosystem there, that it's overproducing methane. And, I mean, cows are natural things. So it got really complex really quickly.
Yeah.
But it's that thinking of carbon's the problem or greenhouse gases are the problem.
Let's put a price on it.
And if we stop them, it'll be okay.
Yep.
And there's immediately, as soon if you just stop it just like that, then it's not going to be okay. It's going to cause all sorts of massive problems. And in fact, I think that's when I discovered regenerative farming and sequestering carbon into soils, which is a much better place to look for a solution than inventing a rule that says we're cutting our output, which will also kill the local economy and create all sorts of massive problems if 90% of the farms no longer have anything to do. It's not a long-term solution.
No, and so that's where I think kind of the systems view is interesting, because I think that's a great example of the more you start to understand systems, the more you realize that the quote-unquote solutions, or at least effective responses, are almost always ecological in nature.
Yeah.
And often local. And again, we can still think global, but act local. And so, you know, that idea of, oh, let's just create a policy change or a new economic incentive to change the market. And again, there's a time and place for that. But ultimately, there's limited effects, I think, that those kind of interventions can have.
But that also comes back to what you were saying about the stability of the economic system. When even though people are saying, you know, everyone loves to talk about a crisis, but it's actually the economic system is very stable at the moment. Mm. You can't change it. So probably all they could do is like those little tweaks.
Yep, that's it.
On the outside, and maybe if we're lucky, we'll have a monstrous economic disruption and be forced to create a new economic system that actually accounts for the cost to the planet. I don't know if I want to live through that, but maybe that's when it's actually going to be resolved. I don't know.
Well, I think to a certain extent, one of the conscious choices I've made is in this kind of late phase of conservation that I think we're in now.
And that's what you call it, the economic and political cultural system stable, but it's near the end of a stable period.
That's exactly what you're saying. So thanks for clarifying that. Is one of the best things I think I can do right now is, you know, things like plant trees and try to contribute to local food sovereignty here. But then with, I guess, the kind of what I think I know about the world is focus on education, you know, kind of seed planting.
Yeah.
Because those seeds might not germinate now, and people, you know, I think would easily dismiss a lot of the things I have to say because they look around the world and go, oh, everything looks pretty good to me. But then when there's a disruption, some of those ideas start to germinate and people go, oh, actually, maybe there is a different
way.
Maybe there is a better way.
Yeah.
And so right now when there's a limited opportunity, I think, for significant behavior change, you can still do the groundwork to start.
In fact, it's necessary.
I think it is necessary.
Yeah.
And another thing that I'll just mention now for people who are interested in this and particularly thinking about, well, then how do I meaningfully engage or try to influence a system? There's a great paper that a woman, one of the pioneers of system science, named Danella Meadows, she was her and Dennis, I guess, were the lead authors of probably the most significant ecological publication of the last century, The Limits to Growth, Club of Rome report. So she was the lead author for that. But she wrote a paper called Leverage Points in a System. And she looks at the 10 opportunities, I guess, to shape and influence a system. And she looks at it from the perspective of what has the most, and or she kind of grades them in terms of the level of impact or influence that those have. So there's a lot of things that we can do that have very little influence, and there's some really, really hard stuff that has a huge impact on the system. And what she identified is the opportunity for greatest change is paradigm shift. And so you know, in our context, I think that's about a mindset and a cultural values and behavioral suite of things there. And, you know, everyone's trying to crack that nut, but it's a really hard one to crack.
And you don't know when it's going to happen. I know everyone talks dismissively about the boomers these days, but the baby boomer generation in the 60s got really radical. And people talked about in the US universities there, like, people had been working away on these issues in obscurity for ages, and then all of a sudden it took off, and they said the quote I heard was that even the jocks were having teach-ins, right? It just suddenly took out everyone who got involved, and and it changed the world for a while. So yeah. Anyway, we've gone over time by about 10 minutes. I don't know how I'm going to edit this all back in for tomorrow's replay, but anyway, we'll give it a go. We've been talking to Finn Mackesy, a permaculture man who comes in every few weeks, and thank you for coming in. And I don't know how we did with that. We'll have a little review after we get off the air. Systems is a very interesting topic if you can get your head around it.
And a very long piece of string.
Yeah, very long piece of string. Yeah. Thanks for coming in, Finn.
Thanks for having me.
All right, folks, there we go. That's the first show of the year over and done with. And I will, of course, will I be back tomorrow? It's actually a public holiday. I haven't even decided, but I think I've got an interview book, so maybe I better come in.